I'm Jason Kander, and this, unfortunately, is an emergency edition of Majority 54, the podcast that is meant to help you talk about, the most divisive stuff in the news with your friends, your family, your coworkers who are leaning in the wrong direction politically. And Robbie, we have a real challenge here because we got to somehow help people deal with the news that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has passed away.
Yeah. I mean, what a tragic day for American history. Such a titan on the court and a champion of not just women's rights, but the rights of the most vulnerable in this country throughout history. And somebody who, as a lawyer and as a justice, has really changed the face of this country. I'm honestly, we're recording this only minutes after we learned this news, and I think, like most people, it's almost left not knowing what to say about it all, Jason. What are your first impressions?
My first thought was, what an incredible fighter, like throughout her life, but also, even at the end, like it was very clear that she was not going to stop fighting for the causes she cared about, and that turned out that meant that she died while serving. And it was obvious that was never anything other but her intention. Like, she was going to be there as long as she needed to be there to do everything she could to preserve the possibility of protecting the court from the people who wanted to do the exact opposite of what she wanted to do on the court. And that's admirable. Like, I mean, that's fought to the very end.
Yeah, I think, when we both went to law school, and they teach you this case in law school, Reed versus Reed, from 1971. And this was a case that she pushed. She wrote a merits brief for it. And it was the first case to hold that the Constitution restricts discrimination on the basis of sex. And this was a huge project of hers, she was instrumental in convincing the legal community of this argument. And at the time that she and others were able to successfully convince the Supreme Court back then in 71, there had only been 9 women appointed to the federal bench in American history, and none of them had sat on the Supreme Court. And so she and others had to convince 9 men of an argument that the Constitution discriminated on, the Constitution protects against discrimination on the basis of sex, and she did. I mean, that's the kind of person she was. And she's fought against... She's basically been pushing the boulder uphill her entire lives. And I think one conclusion I have right now is we've got to step in and grab that boulder. And as sad and hopeless as it can feel right now, she was the kind of person who faced down insurmountable odds continuously and has to be our inspiration as we head till November.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's probably a little cliche to say that she wouldn't want everyone to, feel anything but hopeful or to stop fighting. But I think it's quite literally and apparently true, right? That she, that's not what she would want. She would want, if anything, for people to draw inspiration from this. So it's really sad. I mean, for one thing, like, it's really sad for America, but also, she has a family. At the end of the day, they're just people who lost a family member who I'm sure that they have an incredible amount of love for. So I'm at least comforted to read that, she died with her family around her. I think she certainly deserved that. But now it is our job to talk about what happens next and then talk about what the people listening to this can do about what happens next. So,
yeah.
Robbie, what happens next?
Yeah. Well, some short-term not good things. But there's what people outside of our control are going to do, and I'm going to start with that. But then I think we need to end with what we can control, because for mental health reasons and for the effectiveness of the next few months, we need to focus on what we can control. So just to give people a scene setter, before Justice Ginsburg passed away, the court was split between 4 liberals, 4 very, very conservative justices, and Chief Justice John Roberts, who's a conservative who had been signaling in some ways that he was an institutionalist in some ways and wanted to preserve some of the integrity of the court. And there's cynical people out there who would disagree. I wouldn't just say they're just cynical, but there are people who would disagree with me about my assessment of Roberts. But there is, even quantitatively, you could see there's been some good work done by the Washington Post and Vox to show, like, they chart his movement leftward in his decisions. And then they say that it's Roberts's leftward movement of the past few years is even more rapid than David Souter's, which was a pretty rapid leftward movement. So there's some reason for hope there, but that was a 4-4-1, which was really a 5-4 conservative split on the court before this,
I think we should make sure we characterize Roberts as, I think it's clear Roberts moved in response to what was happening around him on the court, right? Like, don't think he ideologically changed. I think he said, okay, you know, when the thing happened with Merrick Garland and everything, and I don't know what his reasons were, but he clearly, and I think you used the right term, institutionalist, he has at least occasionally said there are lines. We don't know where those lines are, and I don't think he knows where those lines are, but he seems to have an idea that he has some responsibility to not let things get, well, they got out of hand, but to not let things get out of hand all the time.
Yeah, totally. And I totally agree. And so I want to just say that that's a trend that we're going to continue to watch, but it's a trend that only mattered in a world where it was 4-4-1.
Right.
Now, when it's a world 6-3, which is the likely world. So let's talk about that. So the Senate confirms justices. We can't filibuster it anymore under the current rules. And so it's just a Republican majority. There are Republicans. The only hope we have here to stop this is there are enough Republicans in vulnerable seats that if you are in North Carolina and you're in Maine and you're in Colorado and you're in Iowa and you're in South Carolina, like, you as a voter, as an activist, you, like, one thing, I'm getting a little ahead of it, but one thing you can keep in mind is that, like, these senators who are up for re-election in these states can stop this appointment. And why would they stop it? Well, because they blocked Merrick Garland under a principle espoused by the right and by Mitch McConnell that in an election year, you wait for the results before you appoint. That was their bullshit, but a public excuse for not filling that seat. And so I'm getting so upset about this.
That's that okay. I'm getting ahead of our thing. Just flow with it, man. It doesn't matter.
I'll pause before I get to that other stuff. So McConnell will push for this vote. There will be tremendous pressure on the right to fill this seat. It is likely that they fill it, but we can and must fight this thing like hell. The challenge is going to be fighting it at the two-front war here. Obviously, there are many fronts in the country right now, but the two-front war of this fight over the nomination and the election, and we have to bridge the two. We have to make it the same point talk about the implications of this vote.
We should point out that this possibility has been raised in the past with people like McConnell, people like Lindsey Graham. And one of the things they have said, now this is a ridiculous delineation or distinction, but this is the argument I've heard them make, which is, well, with Merrick Garland, you had a Democratic president and a Republican Senate. You had a split government, right? The argument being that therefore there was no consensus. And that in this case, what they're going to say or what McConnell's going to say is, well, you have consensus. You have a Republican president and a Republican Senate, so there is no reason to wait, which is, of course, makes no sense, and it's just a collection of words that technically make up a sentence, but it's not an argument. But that doesn't matter. That they have the power. That's all they need. So I think you're right. There is the question of, if you're Lindsey Graham, or if you're Cory Gardner, or if you're Susan Collins, you know, these folks, does this potentially cut? Now, I think in Maine, I think it could very well cost her the election, because, you know, Maine is a place that is a majority. I think Maine is a state that the majority of the voters would want a more liberal justice, and the majority of the voters have just been willing to compromise to have a Republican senator. But that said, like, you know, if you lose your base politically, then it makes no difference, right? You got to win the division before you can win the pennant. So I don't know where they come out. And I think you're right. I think we have to operate under the assumption that they're going to force their hand.
It could, you know, it's worth mentioning, it could help some of these Republican senators. So,
right. Could rally their base.
Well, there's another version of this, right? If you're Susan Collins and you vote against the justice, that could be good politics for you. It certainly would be. I'd be advocating both morally and politically. Like, you'd be able to say, hey, I am that centrist. And the question is, how much of the conservative base defects in a state like Maine? I think she kind of actually, this could work for her.
It could. You know? Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure she's an avid listener to the program. And so we should make sure, you know, I'm sure right now she's drafting a letter about her grave concerns. And, you know, maybe she should stop doing that and take a poll. But which I'm sure she's also doing, by the way. But yeah, so, okay, first step is, I mean, look, not to be like overly hokey, but what would RBG do? You fight it one step at a time. You fight like hell the first step. And the first step is we got to do everything we can to stop this. And that's going to mean organizing in these states. Fortunately, in a lot of cases, these are states that we're already fighting this out in. And so, look, for people listening, if what you've been doing is making calls into Georgia, making calls into, you know, Colorado, making calls into Maine, like, keep doing that. Because that's going to matter a lot in the very short term.
I'm going to be really curious to see if they rush this vote before the election, which is what I think they're going to do, versus wait until after the election, which could preserve some of these politics for the Senate candidates. But I think what the risk in waiting until after the election is that some of these Senate candidates, are they going to waffle between now and the election about what they believe in? It's only going to hurt them. So, but McConnell is one of the smartest people in politics. He's a complete reptilian brain. He has no morals. So, but he is very good, and he is going to do some, he's going to be pretty devious about this. And so we got to keep an eye on him about that. So it's worth mentioning what the implications would be if, and in likelihood scenario, that they do fill this seat with a conservative. If you just looked at this past term, there was a case, McGirt versus Oklahoma, which ruled that much of eastern Oklahoma is an Indian reservation. So this is land for Americans who've been marginalized longer than anybody else. There's the June Medical Services case, the Louisiana abortion law case, which was 5-4. There's the DACA case, which is 5-4. There have been historic ACA cases that have been 5-4. So we're talking about massive, massive policy implications just from the past few years. So this is huge. Now, one other thing to talk about before we kind of transition to some more, what do you do? How do you talk to your family about this? Is that we have the ability, if Biden wins and we win the Senate, to add seats to the Supreme Court, and we better effing do that if they fill this seat.
I was wondering what you were going to say. I think you made it pretty clear.
I mean, I don't know if you agree, but like,
I do. I do agree.
Disrespecting the institution at this point, like, it's like we already have the Garland one. I think if I were advocating for this, I would go for two. And if the Manchins of the world think that's too much, then we go for one, but at least one. To settle the score over Merrick Garland. And this is not like some kind of revenge fantasy. This is just about people's lives, right? And saying, look, like, if you're going to mess with the institutions of the U.S. government, the Supreme Court has changed numbers, for people who don't know, over time. And so there's nothing sacred about the number 9. Now, we should have kept it sacred because it's very helpful for just the stability of our already screwed up politics to just keep the number at 9 and have a truce. But the minute they did the Garland stuff and then are going to turn around and violate that principle, we have no reason to respect some arbitrary rule that they don't respect.
So I think let's do something that we don't usually do on this podcast, which is what should Biden do? Or not even what should Biden do? What should, what should people running for office right now do? What, you know, that kind of thing. So we'll make an exception.
Go for it. Yeah.
And here's what I think. This is just my own personal view. Look, I don't like the fact that politics have become in America about who holds power, and that you can end up with, you know, vertical integration of power. Just, you know, I don't like it. It's where we are at this moment. And so in my view, what I would do right now, I would say, look, I don't believe, based on their prior behavior, I don't believe it is fair to the American people to make this appointment. You know, the person who wins this November, that's the president who should make the nomination. And then I would, which we all agree with, and I would say,
yeah, and he should frame that, because I'm sure he said the opposite during Merrick Garland. So I would frame it in saying,
it's saying because of the
principle
what
that's been laid. Yeah, because of the principle that's been laid. Because, out.
You know,
yeah.
And say this is not what I believed before, but that's what they did, and it would be unfair to the American people to be inconsistent. So if that's what they're about, then they should stick with that. And then I would say, and if they don't, on behalf of the American people, as the next president, I will undo that wrong. I will right that wrong. And so then you say, like, look, I don't want to change this norm. I don't want us to have more than nine. I don't want it to be that if you're president and you have the Senate, then all of a sudden you can put enough through to create a majority for your side. But if that's what they want, it's their decision. That decision is Mitch McConnell's. If that's what he wants to have happen, then appoint somebody right now or after the election before I take office. It's up to you. I'm not making the decision, Mitch McConnell. You're making the decision.
I would go a step further. You might disagree with me on this one, but I would be like, I'd be a little gangster about it. I'd be like, look, to teach you a lesson, we're going for two if I win.
Right, exactly. No, it's an ultimatum.
Yeah.
It's not even I'm not going to, it's got a, you know, it's this, I am so against this that I have to make it clear that it's unacceptable and therefore there has to be a consequence for it.
And you turn into an advantage because, look, we wanted Biden to do this before this, right? So I think the politics of this get easier for him in a situation where if he says before the election, look, you don't fill this until I get it, like the president, the next president sits with the next Senate, I won't push for additional Supreme Court seats. But if you do it, I'm going for two. And you did this to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You did this to all of us.
You know, how much do you want to bet on President Trump?
Yeah, you know? And that I think will matter. I think if I'm a conservative, I would think twice about that one.
Because
everybody knows we've got, they would rather be us than them with the numbers.
Exactly.
That we have
right now. And look at where they were. They are in the exact same position that they were in 2016. And here's why. Because Mitch McConnell understands what he understood then and why he blocked Merrick Garland or why they were like, no, we're blocking Merrick Garland. And then the next time they're like, no, we're pushing through our own, right? Why did they do that? Because they thought in 2016 that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president. That's why, right? And they were like, but they weren't like, we're holding out in case Trump wins. They were like, we are holding out because we think it's going to give us votes. And they were right. As somebody who was on the ballot, I can tell you that it is one of many things that was probably the difference in a lot of Senate races, including mine. And, you know, one of them is the Comey letter, but there's other stuff. And so, you know, that motivated a lot of people to get out there and vote in Senate races that otherwise would not have. I mean, I have no problem believing that there were a lot of people who were Trump voters who didn't like their Republican senator and weren't going to vote for them, but because of the possibility of that Supreme Court seat, they did. And he knows that. And he's got the same motivation, but now he has a different calculus because now he can have somebody saying, you better be right. You better win.
And you know what the number one meme I see out there to convince Bernie supporters and others or non-voters or people who are not considering voting for the Democrats who lean towards the progressive side. The number one meme I see out there before this day was, do you want Trump appointing more Supreme Court justices or not? And that argument's only going to get more potent. So that's the advice for Biden. I think it's like keep it cool and be like, look, this is in your hands. Like the bird is in your hands. Like, you know, the old Korean proverb, like the bird is in your hands, Trump. And so you do this, you're going to piss off all of us. We'll walk through fire to cast this ballot. And we're going to double up once I get into office. And you're also going to compromise your own senators on this kind of stuff who are in critical re-elections. And you're just going to make them look incredibly partisan and unprincipled. Anything else on the Biden front before we talk about quickly how to talk to your families and then get on with our Friday nights?
Yeah, I've probably said too much publicly about what I think Biden should do as somebody who is helping the campaign. But I will say, I do think it's valuable for us to move to the next piece, which is how should everybody, because this is going to be the topic, no matter what, this is going to be the topic for the next, I want to say a few weeks, but I never know in American politics anymore. I think the instinct is to talk about fairness. And I'm trying to figure out if you're talking to somebody, if they're going to care about that. I think it's more about, about the idea that we don't want America to be a place that's this unpredictable, that's not good for America.
Yeah, I think it's that. I think keeping calm. Like, I think the tone of where we got to at the end of the past part is like, you know, my relatives, you know, like my dad, and sometimes my brother and other relatives, they kind of turn into like a little bit of a bully mode sometimes when they get to this stuff, and they almost want me to whine about it. So I don't give that to them. So, you know, when I'm sitting around with them, I'd be like confident in the outcome of this election. I'd be like, look, this helps us. Like, you being an ass and your entire party being an ass on this kind of stuff is bad for the country, but is going to give us what we want, which is we want House Bill 1, we want DC statehood, and we want to add seats to the Supreme Court. But we are tethered to norms and institutions, and so it's hard for us to get to that place. But, you know, like you know, when Bill Belichick in the locker room puts up the newspaper article of the opposing team talking shit before that week, it gives us something heading into the election where you're like, I wish this didn't happen, but I want you to read this article, and then I want you to run through this brick wall on the way to victory, and savor it even more. And so just taunting them almost is almost the best way. I know this is, I never say this on Majority 54, but being like, look, if this is the way you want to go, this is not a good faith disagreement. This isn't like, hey, like,
no.
We have a different belief on where life begins or something.
This is about power.
You know?
It's about power.
Yeah. And like, in that case, you don't owe somebody like some kind of cordial conversation about it. In
right.
my opinion,
yeah. I think one, you want to, I think you want to avoid as much as possible making it. I mean, because what we're really talking about is a great American died, right? And so we don't want to be in a, solely in a back and forth about what that means for the strategy of this or that. So I think you want to acknowledge that and you want to say something about that. And then I think you want to take that and say, and here's why people like me consider her a great American. And you talk about the things that matter to you so much on the court. So if this is a process argument, if you are arguing with someone who voted for Trump or who is considering voting for Trump, if you try and make this about process, they're going to have two reactions. One, I don't care enough about politics to care about the process. I'm not invested in this norm. You're probably talking to somebody who's not an attorney. You know, right? I mean, like, they don't care about that. And the second thing is, well, look, I've been for the side that now has the power. So why would I care about that process? So I think instead, you do what has always been to our strength, and that is to engage on the issues that are decided before the court. And that is, you talk about voting rights, you talk about, you know, everything having to do with voting rights, you talk about In Citizens United, you talk about money in politics, and then depending on your audience, you may talk about the right to choose. You may talk about, the rights of LGBT folks, the rights of, everybody in this country. And
so you're proposing an alternative to taunting your relatives, which I think is very constructive. Look,
I think it depends on how close they're. If it's your dad or your brother, and now I've never met your dad or your brother, but I'm starting to get to feel like I know at least your dad.
I want to give my brother an out, because the last conversation I had with my brother, he was in a different place than I've seen him. So I want to acknowledge his evolution. My dad is a full-blown Scientologist about this kind of stuff, in the way his mind works.
What a funny way to put that.
Yeah. His mind just doesn't, like, it's like a brick wall. But I like what you said, because that also, we get a lot of voicemails about talking to Bernie voters, and this is an opening if there ever was one. I mean, not to mean to bed Bernie voters writ large, but Bernie voters who are questioning whether they should support
to motivate people.
Biden. Yeah, because I want to be clear, there are tons of Bernie voters who turned around and supported the nominee,
yeah.
So I don't want to be
disrespectful. And the thing about this is, like, yeah. We always talk about it in terms of how people vote, but one thing I have actually been meaning to point out for a few episodes is that our listeners have a responsibility to do more than just motivate people to vote for our side, because this can have every bit as much to do with winning. You also have to have the tools to motivate or to make an argument to motivate people to do more than vote, to motivate people to get out there and to knock on doors, or in this case, to make phone calls and text bank. So that's a really important part of this. And frankly, the other thing I've been meaning to mention on the show is that, you know, if you don't win an argument with somebody who disagrees with you and is with the other side, you might just win just enough to where they don't pull a shift volunteering for the other side. And so this is all a part of that.
Exhaust them. Yeah, exhaust them. So, given we're Friday night, we'll
ride
off into the
up.
Sunset. But, rest in peace, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 87 years old, born March 15th, 1933, was famous till the end for her workout routine. And so, you know, Jason, let's do 87 second planks this weekend for her and tag it to the majority 54 account. And then
it's a good idea. I like that.
Then let's give all the pain to the other side from here on out after that. All right.
Perfect closing, man. I'm not even, well, I'll do the end, which is, remember, we all have a platform. Make sure to use yours today.